who have had homosexual relationships as adults. Whatever the causal route, however, none of this implies whatsoever that sexual orientation is a choice. In fact, it implies quite the opposite, since, as we know from the rubber lover and foot fetishist we met earlier in this audiobook, prepubertal erotic experiences can later consolidate into irreversible sexual orientations and preferences. It is fashionable these days, particularly in the West, to say that one is born gay. I appreciate the anti-discriminatory motives and believe strongly that this attitude reflects an increasingly humanitarian ethos toward sexual minorities. But if we think about it more critically, it's exceedingly odd and nonsensical to refer to a newborn infant still dripping with amniotic fluid as being a member of the LGBT community. Yes, it requires prodigious degrees of stupidity to talk about what makes one's genitalia become tumescent as being a conscious choice, but it's far from obvious that every person shoots equally out of their mother's birth canal with an already discriminating taste for penises over vaginas, or vice versa. Then we arrive at the most important question of all. Why do parents worry so much about whether their child may or may not be gay? You might not be one of these fretful parents. In fact, you might like to see yourself as being indifferent to your child's sexuality as long as he or she is happy. Then again, all else being equal, I suspect we'd be hard-pressed to find parents who would actually prefer their offspring to be homosexual rather than heterosexual. Evolutionarily, needless to say, parental homophobia is a no-brainer. Gay sons and lesbian daughters aren't likely to reproduce unless they get creative. And I would imagine, on a viable hunch, that even in today's most liberally minded communities, coming out of the closet to parents is a much easier thing to do for gay individuals who have the luxury of demonstrably straight siblings who can carry their own reproductive weight. As for me, with a breeding older brother and sister, not to each other, mind you, and their little respective litters of my fantastic nieces and nephews, my father at least doesn't have to worry about his genes going extinct. In any event, I think it's far better for parents to recognize the source of their concerns about having a gay child as being motivated by unconscious genetic interest than it is to have them fibbing to themselves about being entirely indifferent to their son or daughter turning out gay. And bear this in mind, parents. It's also important to stress that since genetic success is weighed in evolutionary biological terms as the relative percentage of one's genes that carry over into subsequent generations, rather than simply number of offspring per se, there are other, though typically less profitable ways for your child to contribute to your overall genetic success than humdrum sexual reproduction. For example, I don't know how much money or residual fame is trickling down to, say, Katie Lang, Elton John, or Rachel Maddow's close relatives, but I can only imagine that these straight kin are far better off in terms of their own reproductive opportunities than they would be without a homosexual dangling so magnificently on their family trees. The very thought of making love to a blood relative of Michelangelo or Hart Crane, irrespective of anything else about that person save his heritage, makes me strangely and instantly aroused, and I'd imagine such a person would be eminently desirable to heterosexually fecund women as well. So here's my message. Cultivate your little pre-homosexual's native talents, and your ultimate genetic payoff could, strangely enough, be even larger with one very special gay child than it would be if 10 mediocre straight offspring leaped from your loins. There's one final thing to note, and that's in reference to the future of this research and its real-world applications. If researchers eventually perfect the forecasting of adult sexual orientation in children, what are the implications? Should broad-minded mothers be insouciantly describing their Oshkosh-begosh-wearing toddlers as bi, or fathers relaying how their straight daughters started eating solid food or took their first steps at the grocery store today? Would parents want to know? Parents often say to their gay children in retrospect, "I knew it all along." But hindsight is 20/20, and here we're talking about the possibility of really, definitively, no doubt about it, knowing your child is going to be gay from a very, very early age. I can say as a once pre-homosexual pipsqueak that some preparation on the part of others would have made it easier on me, rather than constantly fearing rejection or worrying about some careless slip-up leading to my exposure. It would have at least avoided all those awkward, incessant questions during my teenage years about why I wasn't dating a nice pretty girl, or questions from the nice pretty girl about why I was dating her and rejecting her advances. And another thing, it must be pretty hard to look into your pre-homosexual toddler's limpid eyes, brush away the cookie crumbs from her cheek, and toss her out on the streets for being gay. Part 7. For the Bible Tells Me So. Good Christians, but only on Sundays. This is a difficult confession to make because on the surface, I'm sure it sounds wildly hypocritical. Still, here goes. I trust religious people more than I trust atheists. The hypocritical part is that I happen to be an atheist with unshakably strong godless convictions. I've written in The Belief Instinct, and I've tried to explain at considerable length, in fact, why I feel this particular way, but for our purposes here, the only important thing to know is that I've not a sliver of agnostic hesitation in my belief that there is no intentional God, at least not a very intelligent one. I also suffer some trepidation before religious people in general whenever discussing anything of moral substance, since it's long been my opinion that God is the great obfuscator, unnecessarily complicating many otherwise straightforward humanistic matters. So now that I've come out of the atheistic closet, entirely undressed, how can I possibly say that I trust those who believe in God more than those whom I'd otherwise consider to be sympathetic and like-minded thinkers? Well, trustworthiness is a different thing altogether from intellect, and I suppose I'm ever the social pragmatist in my dealings with other people. Take, for example, a situation I found myself in outside a rail station in an Irish seaside town years ago. My luggage in hand, the cold gray sky windy and threatening to rain, I was confronted with two taxis at the curb waiting for passengers. One of the cars had a crucifix dangling from the rearview mirror and a dog-eared copy of the Bible on prominent display on the console. The other taxi showed no trace of any religious icons. Now, all else being equal, which of these two taxis would you choose? Considering also that you're trying to avoid being overcharged, a practice for which this part of the country is notorious, and being an American during the W administration, I might add, elevates you one step above our 43rd president in respectability. Both drivers are in all probability devout Catholics. This is Ireland, after all. Still, there's no way to know for certain. Unless you're trying to make a point about how atheists are good people too, or you happen to despise the Catholic Church, it's really a no-brainer. Go with God. Why is this so obvious? As the political scientist Dominic Johnson has argued, if supernatural punishment is held as a belief, then this threat becomes a deterrent in reality, so the mechanism can work regardless of whether the threat is genuine or not. In other words, from a psychological perspective, the ontological question of God's actual existence is completely irrelevant. All that really matters in the above case is that the taxi driver is fully convinced that God doesn't like it when he cheats his passengers. This theoretical supposition that believers behave better because they feel that God is watching them and presumably communicates his displeasure about their sinful deeds in the shape of various misfortunes is one of the most compelling scientific arguments for the sheer stickiness of religion in society today. God just won't go away, and much of the reason he won't, goes this purely mechanistic evolutionary logic, is that the cognitive illusion of a punitive God functions to stem the selfish behaviors of individuals and helps to sustain social harmony. A number of studies have offered empirical support for this supernatural monitoring hypothesis. This is a term coined by Ara Norenzayan, who in multiple studies has found that when participants are implicitly primed with God-related words, such as spirit, divine, sacred, and so on, they become both more pro-social and less anti-social. By contrast with non-religious or neutral words, people who see such religious words, for example, donate more money to a charity after completing a word scramble task in which they cobble the words together into some coherent sentence. Although he and his collaborator Azim Sharif favored the interpretation that participants behaved more altruistically in the religious condition because the religious words reminded them that God was watching and therefore judging them, Norenzayan had always been cautious not to conclude prematurely that this was caused simply by concerns about heavenly spying. It's also possible, of course, that these religious words simply activated related social concepts such as benevolence and good deeds, priming altruistic decision-making independent of worrying about God's fretful glares. More recent work, however, has allowed Norenzayan to put those concerns to rest. Getting people to think about God, even unconsciously and even, interestingly enough, among non-believers, indeed triggers some very specific reasoning about their being the targets of someone's visual attention. Norenzayan and Will Gervais found that this basic effect of religious words making people feel visually exposed panned out across a variety of experimental conditions. In one study, for instance, the investigators used the same implicit God-priming method as before, assigning either a religious or non-religious word-scrambling task to believers and atheists. The participants then completed something called the Situational Self-Awareness Scale. And remarkably, regardless of their explicit belief or disbelief in God, all those who'd been exposed unconsciously to the religious words, but not to the neutral words, showed a spike in their public self-awareness. That is to say, they became significantly more cognizant and concerned about the transparency of their social behaviors from an audience's point of view. Furthermore, when people feel their behavior is being monitored, reason Noren Zion and Gervais in a follow-up experiment, they tend to cast themselves in a positive light. This led them to hypothesize that reminders about God would not simply increase self-awareness, but also encourage socially desirable responses. Participants' responses to statements such as, "I am sometimes irritated by people who ask favors of me," and "No matter who I'm talking to, I'm always a good listener," should reflect their beliefs about what God wants to hear, not the truth about these unrealistically positive social attributes. In this study, however, the only people who produced socially desirable responses to the implicit God primes were those who actually believed in God. This means that while non-believers might feel exposed in the wake of receiving implicit God primes, just like believers, this feeling doesn't influence how atheists attempt to portray themselves socially. For believers, in fact, additional evidence shows that God-related cues not only influence their desire to have others see them in a positive way, but actually motivate them to do good deeds. Some of the best support for this is the so-called Sunday effect, first identified by Deepak Malhotra of the Harvard Business School. Malhotra's research has also revealed how it's the context of the situation, particularly the presence or absence of ostensibly holy cues, that flushes out any actual differences in altruism between believers and non-believers. This approach helps to shift away from seeking a simple answer to the question of whether religious people are nicer, reasons Malhotra in Judgment and Decision-Making, and towards assessing when, if ever, religious people may be nicer. Malhotra hypothesized that religious individuals would be more responsive to appeals from charities than would non-religious people, but only on days when they had earlier attended church. To test this prediction, the author collaborated with an online auction house that agreed to systematically alternate its scripted language for encouraging continued bidding. For online participants who'd been randomly assigned to the charity-focused message, the prompt read as follows. "We hope that you will continue to support this charity by keeping the bidding alive. Every extra dollar you bid in the auction helps us to accomplish our very important mission." By contrast, people who'd been picked to receive the competitive message saw this. "The competition is heating up. If you hope to win, you will have to bid again. Are you up for the challenge?" Importantly, Malhotra also had an independent measure of the bidder's religiosity, including their church attendance habits, which he obtained 6 weeks after they'd made their bidding decisions in response to one of these two primes. "The effect size is compelling," he explained. "On Sundays, appeals to charity were 300% more effective on religious individuals compared to non-religious individuals. By contrast, there was absolutely no difference between the religious and the non-religious bidders in the effectiveness of the charity appeals on any other day of the week." There's another interesting Sunday effect finding, too. This one uncovered by chance by the economist Benjamin Edelman, also of the Harvard Business School. In crunching the salacious online numbers, Edelman discovered that the U.S. population is significantly less likely to purchase online subscriptions to pornographic websites on Sundays than they are on any other day of the week. Although much of this may make for common sense, the fact that salient religious cues prompt neighborly decisions and curb social transgressions because they focus the believer's attention on God's hawk-eyed view of their behaviors is tremendously important for understanding the adaptive function of religion. And such effects play out all around us. In many courtrooms across the Western world, for instance, defendants and witnesses must place their hand on the Bible and volunteer to respond to the religious oath, "Do you swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?" And in the ancient Hebrew world, there was the similar oath by the thigh, where thigh was the polite term for one's dangling bits, since touching the sex organs before giving testimony was said to invoke one's family spirits, who had a vested interest in the seed sprung from these particular loins, and ensure that the witness wouldn't perjure himself. I rather like this older ritual, in fact, as it's more in keeping with evolutionary biology. But in general, swearing to God in whatever way it's done is usually effective in persuading others that you're telling the truth. We know from controlled studies with mock juries that if a person swears on, or better yet, kisses the Bible before testifying, the jury's perception of that person's believability is significantly enhanced. After all, who in their right mind would lie before God? Well, as these findings suggest, atheists are more likely to do so. And that's the reason, the only reason, that I'd choose a Catholic taxi driver in Ireland over one who, like me, thinks that little book on the other driver's console is filled with nonsense of papal proportions. God's Little Rabbits. Believers outreproduce non-believers by a landslide. What's that famous quotation by Edna St. Vincent Millay? Oh yes, I remember now. I love humanity, but I hate people. It's a sentiment that captures my normal misanthropically tinged type of humanitarianism well, but it roars apropos on some particular occasions. For example, while I was making conversation at the pizza shop in a small village in Northern Ireland, the topic turned to what I did for a living. Now, this simple query was usually a hard question for me to answer. When I said I'm a professor, inevitably I was asked what I taught. When I said psychology, people giggled uncomfortably about their problems, or replied, as if it were the most original line, that I'm in the right town for that. When I corrected them and said I'm not a clinical psychologist but a researcher, I had to explain what exactly I research. Evolutionary psychology tended to conjure up some bizarre ideas in many people's minds. And so it did on this occasion, as I struggled to articulate the nature of my profession in a cramped pizza parlor with about half a dozen locals eavesdropping as I did so. Somehow or another, as conversations with me so often do, homosexuality came up as an example of a complex human behavior that evolutionary psychologists are still trying to understand. I wish I'd had a notebook in hand to scribble down the young employee's comments word for word so as to provide you with a proper ethnographic account, but here, in a nutshell, is what he very confidently said to me, flavored with the peculiar vernacular flourish found in this part of the world. Aye, don't get me wrong. I've got nothing against gay people. But what I don't get is why they choose to be selfish and not have a family and kids, like, which is what we're here for. How's yous goes against nature by not continuing the line, cause yous can't help the species without having kids. Just seems selfish-like to me. I replied that as a gay man myself, it's not quite as simple as choosing not to reproduce. Since women are about as arousing to me as that half-eaten pepperoni pizza sitting on that table over there, I said, I couldn't get an erection to inseminate a woman for the life of me. I do, however, I continued, get a mighty erection by seeing other men's erections. So therein, I pointed my finger to the heavens for emphasis, lies the true Darwinian mystery. I then took my pizza and left, in haste. But in any event, the exchange reminded me of the German sociologist Michael Bloom's research on reproduction and religiosity. And it occurred to me that religiously motivated homophobia may be at least partially rooted in this assumption that gay people are shirking their human reproductive obligations. I detected a strong whiff of religious residue in the employee's comments about homosexuality, which, given the churchliness of Northern Ireland, probably wasn't my imagination. In evolutionary biological terms, where natural selection occurs at the level of the gene, not at the species level, there are serious flaws in this person's conjecture about lineal reproduction. Modern technological methods helping gays to be parents aside, there are many ways that childless individuals can still be genetically successful, in some cases more so than simply being a biological parent, such as investing heavily in biological kin who share their genes. In scientific parlance, this is known as kin selection or inclusive genetic fitness. Having said that, I'll acknowledge he was not entirely wrong about the prime evolutionary significance of reproduction either. People really do need to reproduce, either directly or indirectly, for nature to continue operating on their genes. This is not the reason or purpose we're here, as that would insinuate some form of intelligent design for human existence. Rather, it's just a mechanical fact. But all of this gets really interesting, says Bloom, where the illusion of intelligent design intersects with a reproductive imperative, essentially the commonplace idea that God wants or intends or demands us, as faithful members of our communities, to have a litter of similarly believing children. You've been blessed with your pleasure-giving loins for a reason, so the logic goes, and that's to get married to the opposite sex and to breed. By God, just look at the Old Testament. Be fruitful and multiply is the very first of 661 direct commandments. God seems to be not merely making a suggestion here, but issuing a no-nonsense order. Bloom has found that those religions that actually put this issue front and center in their teachings are, for rather obvious reasons, at a selective group advantage over those that fail to endorse this stern commandment. He reviews several religions that are either already extinct or presently disappearing because they strayed too far from this reproductive principle. The Shakers, for example, hindered and even forbade reproduction among their own followers, instead placing their emphasis on missionary work, proselytizing, and the conversion of outsiders. But this turned out to be a foolish strategy, evolutionarily speaking. In the long run, Bloom points out, mass conversions happen to be the historic exception, not the rule. Most of the time, only fractions of populations tend to convert from the religious mythology handed to them vertically by their parents, and they convert into different directions. Communities who start to lack young members also tend to lose their missionary appeal to other young people. Therefore, he says, the Shakers overaged and deteriorated. Some religious splinter groups have also tinkered a bit too much with God's reproductive imperative, even exploring eugenics by attempting to perfect communal offspring. Such a calculated, deliberate scheme of human breeding may backfire, however, if it also means preventing couples from reproducing at their own personal discretion. This was part of the downfall of the Oneida community of upstate New York, a 19th-century Christian commune that had a very practical, almost too practical, view of human sexuality. Reproduction was tightly regulated by a eugenic system known as stirpiculture. Over several generations, Oneida community physicians mated men and women who were carefully selected for their genetic health. I saw some of the handwritten medical records while going through the archives at the Kinsey Institute, and I can assure you that the breeding system was real and meticulous. Children born through this process of artificial selection were raised communally, and maternal bonding was discouraged. To prevent unplanned, non-engineered children, the Oneida members implemented a variety of controls, including encouraging teenage boys to have sex with postmenopausal women. This simultaneously stemmed both parties' libidos, and in forging personal alliances between the two, provided important ecumenical tutelage to the youth by the very devout older women. Adult men practiced male continence, a sexual technique in which males do not ejaculate during intercourse. Given that Oneida also had polyamorous relationships, this was key for stirpiculture purposes. All of this may sound logical in theory, even unusually rational as far as religions go, but the tight regulations meant a quick death for the Oneida community. After only about 30 years and peaking at just a couple of hundred members, the religious commune officially dissolved in 1881. Its members, presumably of good genetic stock, but scanty in ranks, went into the silverware trade instead. Today, the Oneida community is known as the hugely successful company Oneida Limited. By contrast, similarly insulated, non-proselytizing religions that encouraged their members to proliferate alleles the old-fashioned way, such as Orthodox Jews, the Hutterites, and the Amish, and also emphasize homegrown faith in which members are born into the group and indoctrinated, are thriving. The story of the Amish is particularly impressive, having seen an exponential explosion in their numbers over a very short span of time. The Amish emerged as a branch of the Anabaptist movement in the aftermath of the Protestant Reformation in Europe, and about 4,000 of them fled Germany to avoid persecution and found refuge in the United States and Canada during the 18th and early 19th centuries. Most people know that the Amish are extremely insular, shunning almost all contact with the non-Amish world, except during the brief Rumspringa, or jumping around period, in which not yet baptized Amish youth flirt with the devilish goods outside before deciding whether or not to return to their family and faith. For boys, one incentive for returning to the community is that if you want to have sex with, that is, marry a local Amish girl, you have to first be baptized, which is only for those who come home. 80% do. What you may not know is that the Amish population has been swelling since its New World inception. With growth rates hovering between 4 and 6% per year, their numbers double every 20 years or so. In 2008, they numbered 231,000. The year before, it was 218,000. Having children is a heavenly blessing, but it's also an official duty. With an average of 6 to 8 children born to each Amish woman, and with 80% of those returning to the group after Rumspringa, this extraordinary growth rate is easy to understand. What's especially ironic, Bloom points out, is that the Amish's original country of origin, Germany, has been succumbing to sharp population declines for decades. The closing of churches has been followed by that of playgrounds, kindergartens, schools, and whole settlements. At least in sheer numbers, then, it seems that the Amish, long ridiculed by their European countrymen as the dumb Germans who wouldn't give up their silly archaic beliefs, are getting the last laugh. In fact, Bloom's research also shows quite vividly that secular, non-religious people are being dramatically out-reproduced by religious people of any faith. Across a broad swath of demographic data relating to religiosity, the godly are gaining traction in offspring produced. For example, there's a global-level positive correlation between frequency of parental worship attendance and number of offspring. Those who never attend religious services bear, on a worldwide average, 1.67 children per lifetime. Once per month, and the average goes up to 2.01 children. More than once a week, 2.5 children. Those numbers add up, and quickly. Some of the strongest data from Bloom's analyses, however, come from a Swiss statistical office poll conducted in the year 2000. These data are especially valuable because nearly the entire Swiss population answered this questionnaire. 6,972,244 individuals, amounting to 95.67% of the population, which included a question about religious denomination. The results are highly significant, writes Bloom. Women among all denominational categories give birth to far more children than the non-affiliated. And this remains true even among those Jewish and Christian communities who combine nearly double as much births with higher percentages of academics and higher income classes as their non-affiliated Swiss contemporaries. In other words, it's not just that educated or upper-class people have fewer children and tend also to be less religious, but even when you control for such things statistically, religiosity independently predicts the number of offspring born to mothers. Even flailing religious denominations that place their emphasis on converting outsiders, such as Jehovah's Witnesses, are out-reproducing non-religious mothers. Hindus, 2.79 births per woman, Muslims, 2.44, and Jews, 2.06, meanwhile, are prolific producers of human beings. Non-religious Swiss mothers bear a measly 1.11 children. Bloom recognizes, of course, the limits in inferring too much from these data. It's not entirely clear whether being religious causes people to have more children, or whether, somewhat less plausible but also possible, the link is being driven in the opposite direction, with people who have more children becoming more religious. Most likely, it's both. Nevertheless, Bloom speculates on some intriguing causal pathways tied to the fact that religious people have more children. We know from twin studies, for example, that the emotional components of religiosity are heritable. Religiosity refers to the intensity of feelings about religion, not the propositional content of particular beliefs. In other words, one identical twin might be a screaming atheist, while the other is an evangelical pastor, but they're both hot and bothered by God. So Bloom surmises that any offspring born to religious parents are not only dyed in the wool of their faith through their culture, but also genetically more susceptible to indoctrination than are children born to non-religious parents. The whole situation doesn't bode well for secularist movements in any event. Evolutionary biology works by a law of numbers, not rational sentiments. Bloom, who doesn't try to hide his own religious beliefs, sees the cruel irony in this as well. Some naturalists, he points out, are trying to get rid of our evolved abilities of religiosity by quoting biology. But from an evolutionary as well as philosophic perspective, it may seem rather odd to try to defeat nature with naturalistic arguments. As a childless gay atheistic soul born to a limply interfaith couple, I suspect, perhaps for the better, that my own genes have a very mortal future ahead. As for the rest of you godless heterosexual couples hearing this, toss your contraceptives and get busy in the bedroom. Either that or perish the thought, God isn't going away anytime soon. Planting roots with my dead mother. Mother's Day is forever tinged with a certain sadness for me because it's the day I accompanied my mother many years ago to the cemetery where she's been interred ever since. Well, that's not entirely true. She didn't die that very day. Death wouldn't come for another 6 months yet. We were in the funeral home to shop for a shiny new casket and make final arrangements for her corpse, an unwelcome visitor that would be arriving sometime soon, though precisely when, even the doctors couldn't say. For her peace of mind, if nothing else, she was intent on tidying up the financial and administrative minutiae that come with dying as a human being. As soon as the umbilical cord is cut, after all, we're attached to another made of red tape, and that one grows longer with each passing year, so that we die tangled up in it in the end. I don't know why she chose Mother's Day of all days for such a lachrymal task as this, but she did have a tragedian heir to her. One, I might add, that was well-deserved given all she'd been through. Before she was 40, she'd had a mastectomy from breast cancer along with several long bouts of chemotherapy. This was followed by cancer in the other breast a few years later and another mastectomy. Within the decade, my parents would have a sudden and bitter divorce, and within a few months of the divorce, just as she was getting back on her feet, she was dealt another heavy blow, diagnosed with late-stage ovarian cancer, and had to undergo more surgeries and 7 more embattled years of chemotherapy. She died, begrudgingly, at just 54. It's a very sad story, needless to say, and unfortunately one that is shared by too many other loving and wonderful mothers who will not be with us on the next Mother's Day. The fact that I was conducting research on people's afterlife beliefs at the time of her death stemmed almost entirely from the many theoretically inspiring and insightful conversations I had with her as she tried to imagine her own afterlife. She leaned towards scientific materialism, but she wasn't an atheist and had an open mind about the whole affair, I think it's safe to say. Among the more unpleasant aspects of this tale, both for her at the time and for my siblings and me still now, were the gloomy logistics of arranging her burial. What sticks out in my mind most of all from that Mother's Day 2000 is the image of my mom with her trembling hands flipping through an L.L. Bean-type catalog handed to her by a pleasant enough but benumbed funeral home director. It was a rather hefty booklet filled with glossy images of all the latest models of caskets, vaults, urns, catafalques, headstones, and other new products then in funerary vogue. This particular collection especially suitable for middle-class cadavers. Since she died near Fort Lauderdale wanting to be closer to her own mother, she found herself in a part of the country especially profitable to the death industry, the area being a geographic hub of the elderly. The whole affair that day left a bad taste in my mouth. There was something so plastic, so slick, so commercial about this business of death that, much like the rest of an overdeveloped South Florida where this bland, freeway-hugging cemetery is laid, felt much too cold to me. Modern cemeteries, with their zero lot lines, perfectly manicured hedgerows, and identical-looking headstones, have become eerily similar to the suburbs. Or perhaps the suburbs have become eerily similar to cemeteries. Either way, what bothers me most of all is that, looking back, it didn't have to be like this. Death is rarely pleasant, of course, no matter how one's body is disposed of. But in recent years, I've become increasingly interested in green burial, a blanket term that refers to any alternative funerary practice in which the deceased is buried in a biodegradable casket or shroud, often in nature preserves, and without embalming preservatives, fluids that keep a corpse pretty, usually just for viewing purposes, that dramatically slow down and disrupt the natural decomposition process. Although it's the subject of continuing debate and the actual health implications remain unclear, these embalming chemicals may become contaminants as formaldehyde and other potentially carcinogenic agents are absorbed into the soil and groundwater. Green burial advocates have cast the issue almost entirely in terms of avoiding the staggering environmental impact of traditional burial. Consider that before this year is over, Americans will bury 827,060 gallons of embalming fluid, 90,272 tons of steel in caskets, 2,700 tons of copper and bronze in caskets, 1,636,000 tons of reinforced concrete in vaults, 14,000 tons of steel in vaults, and more than 30 million board feet of hardwoods, much of them tropical, in caskets. Then there are the countless acres of land bulldozed over for these bald landfills of synthetic human remains. Cremation isn't much of an improvement over things. Going up in smoke may use fewer natural resources than traditional burial, but it also consumes a significant amount of fossil fuels. According to a statement by the Trust for Natural Legacies, a nonprofit land conservation organization working to drive the sustainable growth of green burial practices in the Midwest, you could drive about 4,800 miles on the energy equivalent of the energy used to cremate someone, and to the moon and back 83 times on the energy from all cremations in 1 year in the U.S. There's also the non-negligible problem of mercury being released into the atmosphere whenever a person with amalgam dental fillings is cremated. These environmental concerns alone make green burial an obvious solution. But as a psychologist and one who's also had a negative personal experience with burying a loved one in the traditional manner, I think our conception of death and burial needs a serious rethink. Let's close the lid on those anonymous, revenue-driven, laminated cultural practices of commercial burial that we've all become so complacent with. There's got to be a better way to go about it than what we've been doing all these years. And green burial of one specific form, which I'll outline in a moment, is win-win. Although the idea of green burials in wildlife preserves or park-like settings is not new, and it's likely a desirable prospect for certain future dead souls who prefer absolute oblivion, it seems to me that this is not going to appeal to most individuals because we human beings tend to have a pressing need for symbolic immortality. This was a term coined by the cultural anthropologist Ernest Becker in his book The Denial of Death, but it has since been empirically elaborated by scientists working on terror management theory. The basic idea behind symbolic immortality is that cultural artifacts that survive the individual's literal death, while also containing some reminder of the person's special existence, can meaningfully reduce human death anxiety. There are many nuances to terror management theory in this construct, but the important point to mention here is that a sense of symbolic immortality can be obtained by concrete markers of prosperity, anything from benches in the park with dead people's names etched in gold, to graffiti on boxcars, to initials carved into a tree, to headstones in a graveyard. So while conventional cemeteries may be unnecessarily gloomy, they do at least satisfy this psychological need for people to remain embedded, even if just symbolically by way of lifeless granite headstones, in the immortal culture. If the green burial industry is ever to take off and begin appealing to more people, I suspect that this is one key issue, physical memorializing, that advocates are going to need to address. It seems to me that the only way to solve this problem while remaining true to the central philosophy of green burial is to have people buried beneath a specific tree, a little sapling of your choice nourished by your decomposing body beneath. In favorable soil conditions, a non-embalmed body, skeleton and all, can rot away entirely within about 15 to 25 years. But many tree species, let's not forget, can live for many hundreds of years, some thousands. Imagine that on making final arrangements at the funeral home someday, you and your loved ones were able to choose from among a wide variety of cohabitable tree species to find just the right tree to suit your fabulously unforgettable being. This instead of flipping through a catalog filled with caskets, coffins, and crypts, as my mother found herself doing. Not only will your death nourish a new life, but you're also saving another tree, the one that would be sacrificed for your sake in the shape of a mass-produced coffin with plastic handles. In addition to offering a healthy dose of symbolic immortality, this form of specific tree burial would tap into another central aspect of our psychology. In recent years, researchers have found that human beings operate with a strong essentialism bias. We tend to reason implicitly, and often explicitly, as though a person's unobservable essence were transmitted through physical contact with that individual. You'd probably cringe to think of wearing a child molester's eyeglasses or a serial murderer's laundered t-shirt, but have trouble articulating precisely why donning such material causes you so much aversion. Likewise, you may have your deceased grandmother's wedding ring or the old jersey of your favorite football player stashed away somewhere, and these objects are coveted because they're so intimately linked to these adored individuals. In the present context, let's say you buried your beloved dog beneath a rosebush in your garden. If you're anything like me, you'd have a special affinity for that particular rosebush over others, and it would be especially unpleasant should, say, someone uproot it and dangle it before you. Now picture an entirely new brand of cemetery, a planned, verdant, protected land tended by trained arborists and filled not with row after row of bland, lifeless, crumbling headstones, but instead with row after row of living trees. Each tree, selected for regional appropriateness and other suitability factors as advised by arborist staff, would symbolize a unique human existence. Not to get carried away, but perhaps a plaque or marker might be added too, enhancing the symbolic immortality element, but aesthetics would of course vary. These aren't simply trees planted in memoriam of the dead, but leafy chimeras whose veins absorbed individual human lives. I'll go out on a limb here and say that even if one doesn't believe in some ethereal or religious version of the afterlife, it's rather difficult to escape the cognitive illusion that the unobservable essence of each person has been somehow gradually transmuted into his or her individual tree. Two massive walnut trees growing side by side with interlocking branches seem somehow more than mere trees when we learn that they're actually growing upon what was once a husband and wife who lived centuries before. There's no shortage of idyllic essentialist images like this. Grandchildren climbing up their great-grandfather's limbs, children who'd been sickly in life now bursting with the blazing colors of autumn, beauty queens forever fragrant with immaculate cherry blossoms, stillborn infants now magnificent oaks. It would take some time, of course, for this human arboretum to fully mature, but what's the rush? In fact, our species' notorious difficulty in imagining our own psychological non-existence is yet another cognitive factor that makes this particular form of green burial appealing. Since we have no proper analogy for the stateless state of death, we can't recreate consciously in our heads what it felt like to be under general anesthesia, or prior to our conception, or even during last night's dreamless non-REM sleep, the closest we can get to mentally grasping what it will be like to be dead inevitably reifies nothingness. With specific tree burial, this simulation constraint principle of the afterlife finds a non-religious or even religious outlet. For example, you might not believe that you've been literally reincarnated or reborn into the tree, but in envisioning its growth and rejuvenation year after year through all the socially active centuries of human affairs lying ahead, you'll find it rather difficult to refrain from attributing some of your own emotions to this living character of the tree. It would sure be nice to hug a young palm tree in Florida this weekend. Of course, I'd have to worry about Mom's health anew, about her getting a nasty weevil infestation or perhaps being rudely split in two by a thunderbolt, but we'd have worked those acts of God into the contract, the funeral director and I. Part 8. Into the Deep. Existential Lab Work. Is killing yourself adaptive? That depends. Suicide for Your Gene's Sake. Part 1. Most psychological science is the science of being and feeling like a human being. And since there is only one human being that I have or ever will have experience in being, it is not always clear to me where my career ends and my personal life begins. And this was especially true for me recently because, like many other adult gay commentators and horrified onlookers, the raft of gay teen suicides in recent years has reawakened memories of my own adolescent battles with suicidal thoughts. There is so much I want to say about this, in fact, because I'm reminded of the many illuminating theories and studies on suicide I've come across that helped me to understand, and more important, to overcome and to escape from, that frighteningly intoxicating desire to prematurely rid myself of a seemingly interminable hell. If only I could have reached out and gotten hold of Rutgers University's Tyler Clementi's shirt tail before he lunged off the George Washington Bridge, or eased my fingertips between the rope in the neck of 13-year-old Seth Walsh before he hanged himself from a tree in his backyard, I would have pointed out to them that one day they will find beauty even in this fleeting despair. I would tell them that their sexual orientation places them in the company of some of the greatest figures and secular angels in creative history. To name just a few, Michelangelo, Caravaggio, Oscar Wilde, Andy Warhol, Leonardo da Vinci, Marcel Proust, Jean Genet, Hans Christian Andersen, and Tchaikovsky. Finally, I tell them about the scientific research and ideas that I'm going to share with you, razor-sharp reasoning by bright scholars that might have pierced their suicidal cognition just enough to allow them to breathe a little more easily through those suffocating negative emotions. A scientific understanding of suicide is useful not only for vulnerable gay teens, but for all those ever finding themselves in conditions favoring suicide. I say favoring suicide because there is convincing work, all tracing back to Dennis De Catanzaro's largely forgotten ideas from the early 1980s, indicating that human suicide is an adaptive behavioral strategy that becomes increasingly likely to occur whenever there is a perfect storm of social, ecological, developmental, and biological variables factoring into the evolutionary equation. In short, De Catanzaro posited that human brains are designed by natural selection in such a way as to encourage us to end our own lives when facing certain conditions, because this was best for our suicidal ancestors' overall genetic interests. For good-hearted humanitarians, it may sound rather bizarre, perhaps even borderline insensitive, to hear that suicide is adaptive. But remember that this word means a very different thing in evolutionary terms than it does when used in clinical settings. Because natural selection operates only on phenotypes, not human values, even the darkest of human emotions may be adaptive if they motivate gene-enhancing behavioral decisions. It's not that evolution is cruel, but as a mindless mechanism, it can neither care nor not care about particular individuals. Selection, after all, is not driven by an actual brain harboring any feelings about, well, anything at all. In no case does this sobering fact come into sharper focus than with adaptive suicide. Saying that suicide is adaptive may also sound odd to you from an evolutionary perspective because on the surface it seems to fly in the face of evolution's first rule of thumb, which is to survive and reproduce. However, as the evolutionary theorist William Hamilton's famous principle of inclusive fitness elucidated so clearly, it is the proportion of one's genetic material surviving in subsequent generations that matters. And so if the self-survival comes at the expense of one's genetic kin being able to pass on their genes, then sacrificing one's life for a net genetic gain may have been adaptive ancestrally. Before we get ahead of ourselves, let's first ease into the suicide as adaptation argument with a few non-human examples, which come mostly from the insect and arthropod worlds. Take male Australian redback spiders, for instance, which seem content to be cannibalized by, to say the least, sexually aggressive female redback spiders during sex. Aside from putting a damper on an otherwise enjoyable act, being eaten alive while copulating would seem rather counterintuitive from an evolutionary perspective. But when biologists look more closely at the spidery sex, they notice that males that are cannibalized copulate longer and fertilize more eggs than males that are not cannibalized. And the more cannibalistic a female redback spider is, it turns out, the more desirable she is to males, even rejecting more male suitors than her less cannibalistic counterparts. Another example is bumblebees, a species that is often parasitized by invidious little conopid flies that insert their larvae in the bee's abdomen. Once infected, the bumblebee dies in about 12 days, and the parasitical flies pupate until their emergence the following summer. What's interesting about this, however, is that parasitized bumblebees essentially go off to commit suicide by abandoning their colony and spending their remaining days alone in faraway flower meadows. In doing so, these infected bumblebees are leading the flies away from non-parasitized kin, increasing inclusive fitness by protecting the colony from infestation. What is critical to take away from these non-human examples is that the suicidal organism is not consciously weighing the cost of its own survival against inclusive fitness gains. Redback spiders and bumblebees aren't mindfully crunching the numbers, engaging in self-sacrificial acts of heroic altruism, or waxing philosophical on their own mortality. Instead, they are just puppets on the invisible string of evolved behavioral algorithms, with neural systems responding to specific triggers. And, says De Catanzaro, so are suicidal human beings whose emotions sometimes get the better of them. So let's turn our attention now to human suicide. For the mathematically disinclined, it can all be translated as follows. People are most likely to commit suicide when their direct reproductive prospects are discouraging and, simultaneously, their continued existence is perceived, whether correctly or incorrectly, as reducing inclusive fitness by interfering with their genetic kin's reproduction. Importantly, De Catanzaro, as well as other independent researchers, has presented data that support this adaptive model. In a 1995 study in ethology and sociobiology, for example, De Catanzaro administered a 65-item survey including questions about demographics such as age, sex, and education, number and degree of dependency of children, grandchildren, siblings, and siblings' children, perceived burdensomeness to family, perceived significance of contributions to family and society, frequency of sexual activity, stability, intimacy, success of relations to the opposite sex, homosexuality, number of friends, loneliness, treatment by others, financial welfare and physical health, feelings of contentment, depression, and looking forward to the future. Respondents were also asked about their suicidal thoughts and behaviors. For example, whether they had ever considered suicide, whether they had ever attempted it in the past, or whether they ever intended to do so in the future. The survey was administered to a random sample of the general Ontario public, but also to targeted groups, including elderly people from senior citizen housing centers, psychiatric inpatients from a mental hospital, male inmates incarcerated indefinitely for antisocial crimes, and finally, exclusively gay men and women. Many fascinating and rather sad findings emerged from this study. For instance, the greatest levels of recent suicide ideation were in male homosexuals and the psychiatric patients, whereas the prison population showed the most previous suicide attempts. It gets better, sure, but we're always at risk, and this evolutionarily informed model helps gay individuals to face and understand that lamentable reality. But the important takeaway message is that the pattern of correlational data conformed to those predicted by De Catanzaro's evolutionary model. Although the author offers the important disclaimer that the observational nature of this study limits strong causative inferences, nevertheless, he says, the profile of correlations agrees with the notion that suicidal ideation is related to conjunction of poor reproductive prospects and diminished sense of worth to family. Concordance of the data with the hypothesis is apparent in reliable relationships of reproductive and productive parameters to suicidal ideation. One noteworthy thing to point out in such data is the meaningful developmental shift that occurs in the motivational algorithm. Whereas heterosexual activity is the best inverse predictor of suicidal thoughts among younger samples, this is largely replaced among the elderly by concerns about finances, health, and especially the sense of perceived burdensomeness to family. A few years after this ethology and sociobiology report, a follow-up study in suicide and life-threatening behavior conducted by an independent group of investigators seeking to further test De Catanzaro's model, replicated the same predicted trends. As persuasive as I find this model, I still had a question left unanswered by De Catanzaro's basic argument, so I asked him for clarification. Basically, I wanted to know how the suicidal patterns of contemporary human beings relate to those of our ancestral relatives, who presumably faced the conditions in which the adaptation originally evolved, but who in many ways lived in a very different world from our own. After all, even with guns, knives, and drugs at our disposal, committing suicide is not always an easy thing to do, practically speaking. In an article published in Psychological Review, for instance, the psychiatrist Kimberly Van Orden and her colleagues cite the case of a particularly tenacious suicidal woman. She was described as being socially isolated, they write, when she attempted suicide with an unknown quantity and type of pain medication and also opened her wrist arteries. This action led to some degree of unconsciousness, from which she awoke. She then threw herself in front of a train, which was the ultimate cause of her death. Now consider the suicide methods that would have been available to our ancient relatives in a technologically sparse environment. Perhaps a leap from a great height that, if one weren't successful, might have at least led to wounds sufficient enough for the person to eventually die from infection. Starvation, exposure, drowning, hanging, offering oneself to a hungry predator. Okay, so maybe there were more methods available to our ancient forebears than I realized. You see what I mean, though. Today, moving your fingertip but a hair's breadth on a trigger is a surer route to oblivion than anything our species has ever known before. Gun owners might as well have an off button. It's so simple now. This is one of the many reasons that I don't own a gun. De Catanzaro's suicide algorithm is stochastic, which means that the figure it generates for a given individual is in a constant state of flux. But de Catanzaro doesn't see technological advances as particularly problematic for his model. Fossils of suicidal Australopithecines or early Homo sapiens aren't easy to come by, of course, but as he wrote to me, evidence indicates appreciable rates of suicide throughout recorded history and in almost every culture that has been studied carefully. Suicide was apparently quite common in Greek and Roman civilizations. Anthropological studies indicate many cases in technologically primitive cultures as diverse as Amerindians, Inuit, Africans, Polynesians, Indonesians, and less developed tribes of India. Self-hanging was one of the most prevalent methods of suicide in such cultures. There are also data from developed countries comparing suicide rates from the late 19th century through the 20th century. These data show remarkable consistency in national suicide rates over time, despite many technological changes. So, the data actually do not show a major increase in suicide in modern times, although this inference must be qualified in that there may have been shifts in biases in recording of cases. Interestingly, the methods of suicide have changed much more than the rates. For example, in Japan, hanging prevailed until 1950, after which pills and poisons became the primary method. In England and Wales, hanging and drowning were common in the late 19th century, but were progressively replaced by drugs and gassing. Motives, he concludes, may have been more constant than means. I find de Catanzaro's argument that suicide is adaptive both convincing and intriguing, but I do think it begs for more follow-up research. For example, his inclusive fitness logic should apply to every single social species on Earth. So why is there such an obvious gap between frequency of suicide in human beings and other animals? Each year, up to 20 million people worldwide attempt to commit suicide, with about a million of these completing the act. That's a significant minority of deaths, and near deaths, in our species. And there is reason to be suspicious that non-human animal models, such as parasitized bumblebees, beached whales, leaping lemmings, and grieving chimpanzees, are good analogs to human suicide. In our own species, suicide usually means deliberately trying to end our psychological existence, or at least this particular psychological existence. And whereas most other accounts of self-destruction in the natural world seem to involve some type of inner species predation or parasitical manipulation, human suicides are more often driven by negative interpersonal appraisals made by